You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After beginning his career as a wildlife biologist, Paul Nicklin took up photography to bring more public awareness of the polar wildlife that he studied. Today, he devotes months to photographing in the Arctic and Antarctica, diving under ice and camping out in blizzards in the most inhospitable and remote places on the planet. His latest book, Polar Obsession, features intimate photographs that bring to life the animals whose habitats are most in peril as global temperatures rise. Mr. Nicklin is a 3-time Picture of the Year International winner, 10-time BBC Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award winner, and he was on our show in December just before he received the Natural Resources Defense Council's first ever BioGems Visionary Award. We were joined by Francis Beinecke, the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, for a fascinating conversation, and we are re-airing it for you today. I began by asking Francis Beinecke, do you see Paul's photography as supporting the work of the Natural Resources Defense Council?
Absolutely. Paul's work is so powerful, and he can bring the message of how quickly this part of the world is changing due to climate change more powerfully than certainly words can. So our work in the Arctic to protect this last undeveloped ocean is just critically important, and a photographer as powerful as Paul can tell the story more powerfully than we can ourselves.
Now, Paul, there are still people who deny there is such a thing as climate change. Have you noticed changes in the ecosystem during the time you've been photographing and studying the Arctic and Antarctica?
Oh, absolutely, and more importantly than studying it and photographing it, I grew up there since I was 4 years old. I was raised on Baffin Island with the Inuit, in a tiny Inuit community, and it's the change I've seen from the time that I was 5 years old or even a teenager to now, 20 years later, it's unbelievable, and it all ties in and supports the science, and photographically now I'm just trying to translate what the scientists are saying. So change is happening more rapidly than we ever thought.
How did you come to grow up with the Inuit?
My mom was a school teacher, my dad was a heavy-duty mechanic, and they wanted to go to the Arctic for a year of adventure, and they ended up falling in love with it. And after they left 12 years later, I stayed for another 20 years. I really fell in love with the Arctic.
Most people want to get away from the cold, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's once you're there and once you sort of succumb to the cold and you give into it, it's one of the most beautiful places on the planet for sure.
Francis, is it projected that there will come a time when the Arctic will be devoid of ice?
Well, the ice is melting very quickly in the summer. The summer sea ice is at a smaller point than it's ever been historically. So people do expect that within 20, 30 years, the sea ice as we know it will be virtually gone, and there'll be a tiny refuge left for the wild creatures of the north.
Well, except for storms, which some people suspect are connected to climate change. Our weather hasn't changed all that much. Are the poles warming faster than the rest of the planet?
Well, the poles are warming much more quickly. We're looking at a temperature increase of maybe 2 degrees centigrade. It's double or triple that in the north. That's why the CPAC is melting so rapidly in the summer. But we are seeing extreme weather events. Here we are in New York. It's almost 60 degrees. It's December 3rd. We all experienced Hurricane Sandy just a few short weeks ago. Still see the evidence of that, which was really devastating to our city. So, you know, it's not only extreme storm events, it's wildfires, it's droughts. Things are changing across the planet as quickly as possible, and that's a real concern of ours.
Now, Paul, if I were to look at your photographs over the years, would that become apparent?
I think so. I mean, for example, we proposed a story to National Geographic to do a story on Svalbard, Norway, and it was going to focus on polar bears. And we had to unfortunately put our project on hold for 5 years in a row because there was actually no safe navigable sea ice for us to travel on in the summer months in Svalbard, which historically was surrounded by ice. I mean, so, and I think you see the struggles of the animals. You see seals without ice. You see polar bears dead on the ice or dead on land. I mean, we are seeing change, and we're capturing that.
Well, you say floating ice is particularly important for polar bears. Why is that?
Because the summertime, what Francis is talking about, that summer extent of sea ice that remains all summer, around all summer long, actually supports the entire ecosystem. It supports the polar bears that can navigate on this floating ice. They can catch seals. The seals are on their ice resting. Walrus are on the ice. I mean, so the whole ecosystem continues to survive and thrive during the summer months.
And now that we're seeing images of struggling polar bears, do you think the public's awareness is increasing?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, it has to be. I mean, through the science and the communication and the work that NRDC is using, I think that people have to be becoming more aware.
Well, Francis, during the recent presidential election, we barely heard about climate change. What measures is the Natural Resource Defense Council taking to protect the polls?
Well, we think that the most important thing is we have to reduce our carbon emissions. That's what is causing climate change and global warming. And the president can do that using his own authority under the Clean Air Act to control emissions from fossil fuel plants, coal plants. So we're very focused on getting at the root cause in this early part of the next term.
Although he's faced quite a bit of resistance from members of both parties because there are political factors here.
Well, there are lots of political factors, but actually we think that there is a very strong pathway to develop an energy plan that is based on renewables, very maximum investment in efficiency, making our entire energy system more efficient. All of those things will reduce emissions, and we have to get on this pathway. I mean, just today in the New York Times, there's a new article about how emissions in the world are rising faster around the world than has been projected. I can't overemphasize how urgent this issue is for action.
Is it reversible? Because some people have suggested that we've crossed the tipping point.
Well, I think Paul is the one to tell us how clearly the changes are, but we have to minimize the consequences in the future, which is why we have to take action now.
Well, how has global warming affected the Inuit?
Well, they're very much like the wildlife in the Arctic. They are connected to the sea ice, just like the animals. It is one intact ecosystem. If we lose ice, we stand to lose this whole ecosystem. So the Inuit are part of that, and it's affecting their livelihood, getting food for their families.
You say that you saw your first polar bear when you were 5 years old. When did you develop your passion for photographing polar wildlife?
Not till later.
You didn't have a smartphone that could just pull up and say, oh, there's a polar bear, click.
No, I grew up without anything. I mean, without a telephone or television in these Inuit communities. And it was during university that I was in science and learning about science and loving it, but realizing how ineffective I would be as a scientist. And I thought, if I can translate what the scientists are saying, then, and that's when my passion developed. I thought, I can become a translator. And I got really excited about that path as a journalist.
Now, I just want to come back to the whole business about tipping point, Francis. It was announced yesterday, I have just been informed, that the goal to limit the increase in temperature to 3.6 degrees may be becoming unattainable, with carbon emissions at a record high last year. Now, that's despite the fact that we've heard that we have to cut down on those carbon emissions. So,
well, I think
what does
what's
that
happening,
mean for the Arctic? What does that mean for the
regular
world?
It means that the changes we're seeing in the Arctic are probably going to accelerate. And what we can't afford to do is go beyond the point of no return. So the United States has to take action. We have the longest history in major emission sources. But, of course, the developing world, particularly China and India, are growing very rapidly. So this is a worldwide problem. This is not a domestic problem. But in my view, the United States has the authority and it has the responsibility to take action first and take action now. If we can get on a pathway of clean, renewable energy and very efficient energy systems, that's something that we can show the world. We can develop technology, make that available across the world. So, you know, we are actually, NRDC is working globally, but we feel that it's critically important to get action in the United States now.
My guests are Francis Beinecke, the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, and Paul Nicklin, whose latest book is called Polar Obsession. It's a gorgeous book published by National Geographic. Do you see yourself still as a biologist, or are you purely a photographer?
I'm all of it, and that's what I love about sort of the path I've been on. When I'm underwater, say looking at narwhals or bowhead whales underwater in the Arctic, I see myself as an artist. I have to shoot the most powerful pictures possible. I see myself as a scientist looking at a whale that's 250 years old, and I also see myself as a conservationist and a translator. So I'm excited in the job that I'm at that I'm all of it right now.
Whales can live to 250?
Yeah, the bowhead whale is new science is saying is probably the oldest living mammal on Earth right now, 250
And can
years
you
old.
Spot an old one?
You can. You can look at, the scars, and you can look at how white their peduncle is, their tail is, and you can spot an older whale for sure.
When you go on a photo mission, do you have an idea of what you want to create beforehand?
Oh, absolutely. Before I shoot, I have to do a lot of research, and I'll actually, before I'm even pick up my camera, I will sketch all the images that I want to make on a piece of paper, right down to the light, the conditions, the angle, how deep I am. And that really helps me go in there and stay focused. For example, photographing a polar bear in a blizzard, in a really bad blizzard, you might just stay in your tent, but you're like, no, I really need to shoot this image. And so you go out and push yourself harder in bad conditions.
Well, do wild animals allow you to get close to them?
They do, and it's lucky the life I've had being taught by the Inuit to work in these harsh conditions. Through time and patience, you can get close to these animals. It's up to them. They always dictate the encounter.
So do you think they come to recognize you?
I don't think so. I think they recognize your energy. If you're not acting scared and you're not acting aggressive, you're acting really calm, that allows them to calm down, allows you in. But if you're agitated and nervous, I mean, they pick up on that and they don't want anything to do with you.
Is there one animal or behavior in particular that you're eager to capture on film but haven't been able to yet?
I want to photograph it all. And what I love about being a journalist is I want to shoot ecosystems and I want to shoot the whole connective tissue between them. So I love to shoot stories about biodiversity and how it's connected. So yeah, that's what excites me more than an individual animal, for sure.
By the way, we have an amazing slideshow, both underwater and above water, including with narwhals, on our show page at WNYC.org. Leopard seals are usually thought of as being dangerous, but you came very close, into close contact with one. How did she respond to you at first?
I'm getting in the water with her. I was very nervous, but right away, I mean, she came up to me and did a lot of threat displays for several minutes. This is a 1,000-pound seal, 12 feet long. I mean, she's huge. And it was a very humbling, semi-scary moment for a bit. And then she completely relaxed, and so began the journey of her feeding me penguins for 4 days straight, just trying to communicate with me. And that's what I love about these animals. I mean, they're incredibly social, very intelligent. And when they let you in, it can be a life-changing experience.
And by feeding you penguins, she was saying, I consider you a friend or a potential friend?
I think she was trying to communicate with me. She was trying to figure out what I wanted. You know, obviously in their world, you're either going to breed or eat. And we weren't going to breed, so it came down to the food source. And if she could get me to take a penguin, she would understand why I was hanging out with her.
You've described those as the five greatest days of your photographic career.
Yes. Yeah.
You've done some amazing things.
I have. I just had another round of my five greatest days. So now we're up to 10. I just swam with emperor penguins under the ice in Antarctica and 600 feet of visibility. So I've had a lot of great moments.
Did you tell them that you refused to eat any of their relatives when you were offered one?
I know.
By a leopard seal?
I felt like a bit of an imposter for sure.
Francis, how seriously endangered are the animals that Paul's been photographing? Is he creating a record of animals that may become extinct within our lifetimes?
Well, I think that he is. I mean, the polar bear, Paul is an expert on, does depend on sea ice. As the sea ice shrinks, the question is, can the polar bear survive? And I think that, you know, one of the things that's happening in the Arctic, as the ice melts, suddenly the last undeveloped ocean on the planet is becoming ground zero for energy development, for fishing, for marine shipping. So suddenly there is a huge effort across the north to industrialize this last wild place.
And now, you know, we have a Northwest Passage for the first time.
There's a Northwest Passage. The oil industry is poised, you know, whether it's in Russia or the U.S. or Canada, to start to develop those resources as quickly as possible. So we're working very aggressively to try to get a conservation plan in place, to try to get a science refuge to really understand these changes and figure out a management regime before the development occurs, before this last wild place becomes industrialized.
Paul, Werner Herzog made a film called Grizzly Man about somebody who thought that he could coexist with grizzlies. Are grizzlies very different than polar bears?
No, I think all animals are. The beauty of wildlife in general, whether it's polar bears, grizzly bears, Komodo bears, that their behavior is incredibly consistent. Where I get very nervous is in cities where, you know, people are, our behavior as humans is very inconsistent. Is someone drinking, you know, DUI on the highway? It's terrifying. But when you get into these wildlife worlds, as long as you work slowly and you work at the pace of the animal, no matter what species it is, they'll let you know. They'll dictate how close you can be and how close. They'll actually approach you once they're relaxed enough, and that's when I do most of my photography.
They recognize the fact that you're not hostile to them, that you're not trying to kill them?
Absolutely, and I think that what it comes down to is body language. They're giving me body language, and my body language is that I'm not aggressive and that I'm not scared. And when you're neither of those, it allows them to relax, and then you actually end up having a very relaxed encounter with one another.
You say polar bears are easier to find and photograph in Norway not Canada. Why is that?
Well, because in Canada, they shoot 500 to 700 bears a year. And I worked on polar bears in Canada as a biologist, and they were incredibly hard to find. And every time we found one, they were scared, they were running, they were nervous. When you find bears in Norway where they're not hunted, they're very relaxed in general, and you get quite close to them, or they get close to you.
And in Antarctica, on the island of South Georgia, you describe an experience in which the animals were particularly comfortable with you. Is that because they don't recognize humans as predators?
I think so, and I mean, it's just... it's not part of their food chain. We just don't factor into their world of fear. And to stand there amongst 300,000 king penguins in South Georgia and have them completely relaxed, to be that fly on the wall is definitely a photographer's
dream. But you said you were unable to take pictures.
Did I say that?
Yeah. Oh, I thought you said that.
Oh, okay. No, I unfortunately, I mean, I was so excited when I first landed in South Georgia. I was so overwhelmed with the beauty and how close I was standing by all this wildlife. I took 4,500 images in the first 3 hours of being on land, and that just calmed my nerves.
You say narwhals are the most mysterious animals that you've photographed. In what way?
They're just the most elusive and shy, and science is showing that they're more connected to the polar ice, perhaps, than polar bears. And so they have a very close lifestyle with ice. In order to find them, they're out in the broken drifting pack ice where they're feeding on Arctic cod, so it's extremely hard to find them.
So as the ice melts, what does that mean for an animal like the narwhal? Will they just become extinct simply because their habitat has disappeared?
It's having an effect on the whole food chain. So as ice disappears, you lose amphipods and copepods. They lose their breeding ground, which is the ice. And that affects Arctic cod, and the narwhals feed on Arctic cod. So it's ultimately going to decimate their food source.
Didn't you fall through the ice while you were photographing narwhals?
You've done your homework. Very nice. yes, I did. I was on the last day of second last day of the project. We just had the most incredible day of, you know, up in the Arctic. You have to understand how hard we worked to get this. I could talk for an hour about how hard it is to get close to narwhals. But I was sitting there, we were so excited about what we just photographed. And then I fell through the ice. And as I was going under the ice, I grabbed a rope, dislocated my shoulder. And that was the end of the project for us. But as my assistant spent an hour and a half trying to pop my shoulder back into place, I'd wince in pain, and as I did that, all I would see were narwhals and tusks, and I could hear them, and it was a great moment.
They have huge tusks. How long are they?
They get up to 11 feet, but average is probably 7 to 8 feet.
Now, did you fall through the ice because the ice has become thinner than you would have expected in the past?
It's just rotten. I mean, it's tragically... I was working up in the Arctic with a friend of mine, and we kept breaking through the ice traditionally where it was very solid ice. And 3 days after I left him, I went home. He went through the ice, and he actually died of hypothermia.
Mm. How did you avoid hypothermia?
I wasn't there. I'd gone back home.
When you fell through.
Oh, I wasn't in that long. He was in the water, unfortunately, for 45 minutes. I was in the water for maybe 4 or 5 minutes.
Well, when you go into the water by choice, you, I'm sure, are prepared for the cold.
Definitely. I mean, I wear the best dry suits, but you still lose feeling in your face and your fingers and your feet within 5-6 minutes of being under the ice.
So how long can you stay under?
I could stand there for about an hour and 20 minutes is my record on a dive. And by the end, I was hypothermic. I couldn't move. So you just have to try and get out of the water before that point.
And what about cameras? In the past, the shutters would freeze. Is that no longer the case? Are they building them differently?
Oh, they're better. I mean, when you think of digital cameras nowadays, they have no moving parts. So things don't freeze up, and I can shoot now 4,000 images on a single CF card on a dive if things are really happening. And with film, every time you took down a camera, you only had 36 chances to get it right. Now I've got three or four or 5,000 chances to get it right.
You had a life-threatening experience with an elephant seal in South Georgia. Are life-threatening experiences common for you?
Unfortunately, they are. And it's not intentional. I don't want to be a cowboy. I don't want to be out there seeing if I can survive. But, you know, no one had been in the water with breeding elephant seals before. And so you don't know. You have a sample size of zero. So I jumped in the water just to try it out, and it turned out to be a really dumb decision. These animals are not thinking with their brain at that time of year when they're breeding. And it was just a big male who's 8,000 pounds, 20 feet long, who wanted to kill me. And it was a very close call, but...
Did he see you as a rival, do you think?
Unfortunately, yes. I didn't do my homework. I looked on the beach. I thought there was
way too much mating going on, interspecies mating going on in all of these discussions.
Yes. Animals are pretty basic when you break it down. And he had 100 girlfriends on the beach that he was mating, and he was just in the water cooling off. And I swam right up to him thinking he was just a subordinate male and we could hang out, but it turned out to be the big breeding master.
Was that the most dangerous situation you've been in?
That was up there. I've run out of air under the ice, which was scary. I've just crashed my ultralight into a lake upside down and had to swim out of the cockpit. That got my attention. There have been some moments, but definitely the great moments in what I do and bearing witness to all this has been much better than, or I've had much more of those than negative experiences for sure.
We've had a number of calls from people, Francis, who want to know why the NRDC hasn't protested the proposed introduction of a natural gas pipeline under Gateway National Park.
Well, we have I'm not specifically familiar with that natural gas pipeline, but we have a very strong program on addressing the whole range of issues that have to come with natural gas, particularly fracking in New York State and Pennsylvania and Ohio. There's a huge, as people know, huge amount of development in the natural gas arena that's really taken over across the country. There's fracking going on in 30 states. And this is being done without adequate environmental safeguards, without adequate health safeguards in people's communities, in their homes, in their backyards. It's really astonishing the rate of development and how inadequate the state and federal controls are around it. So NRDC is very, very focused on ensuring that those safeguards get in place and that critical areas get protected and not developed in the process.
Is it a hard fight? Because politicians often talk about our need for energy independence.
It's a very hard.
And fracking is part of that. I saw political ads during the last election from people in the energy industry suggesting that you should vote for a certain candidate.
Right. Well, we estimate that as much as $300 million was spent during the election by the fossil fuel industry on pro-development messages. I mean, a huge amount of money. And, you know, there is the energy equation in the United States has changed because of hydrofracking. So there is abundance of natural gas available. And I think that, you know, our number one mission is to get the United States on a clean energy pathway that maximizes renewables, that maximizes efficiency, that minimizes fossil fuel development, and that protects public health and people's homes in the process. And it is a very tough fight because the fossil fuel industry is immensely powerful and they have deep connections in the political world. And, you know, we have to have a sane – I think I have been working under, you know, during the terms of 8 different presidents, all of whom have called for national energy plans, none of which have been adopted. And it's a very serious issue for the country.
And right now there is, as you suggested earlier – a competition for all of the potential energy resources that are under the Arctic. Different countries are claiming that their continental shelf extends far enough for them to all get into it.
Right.
Do you envision a time when we're already drilling in Alaska to the point where I suspect we've sucked most of the oil out of Alaska?
That's what's terrifying. I mean, you've got this huge problem going on with the disappearance of sea ice, and you think, okay, you know, finally people are finally going to get it. They're going to wake up tomorrow, and we're going to take action. We've got to save polar bears, save the ice. We've got to protect this habitat. It's like, no, the governments, Canadian governments, the worst of them all. You know, we got to push deep into this area to make more money. I mean, it's all about money. It's about oil. It's about growth. And that's the terrifying part in this journey.
And many populations around the world who may be the most affected by global warming, like the Inuit, create few carbon emissions. How are they brought into these discussions?
Well, I think that not nearly enough. I mean, in the United States, we have certain relations with the First Nations. In Canada, the First Nations, I think, have a stronger voice than they do in the U.S., but their communities, there are 4 million people in the world who live above the Arctic Circle who are at ground zero of climate change. And it's critical that their voices are heard as people contemplate how we deal with this problem.
What are your major concerns about drilling in the Arctic area? That we will be despoiling the environment or that we'll just be getting more fossil fuels exacerbate the situation in the future?
The number one concern is that this is a fragile, changing area that we don't know enough about scientifically. We need to know what the important qualities of the ecosystems are, where the migratory routes are. Also, I sat on the President's Oil Commission after the Macondo spill in the Gulf of Mexico. One of the things that was very apparent is that we are completely ill-equipped to deal with major spills. That was true in the Gulf of Mexico, where the industry is hugely deployed, has every resource available at their fingertips. None of that is available in the Arctic. The Coast Guard is 1,000 miles away from where they're proposing to drill. They don't have containment systems that are adequate. It's just, you know, nothing has changed in the 20 years since the Exxon Valdez spill, and yet they're determined to go up there. So we're determined to fight it every step of the way and try to get important natural resource ecosystem areas protected, affirmatively protected, to be off limits.
Paul, you said when you came into the studio that you have another book on the way. What will that have?
I've been focusing a lot on the bears of the north, so polar bears, black bears, spirit bears, and grizzly bears. And I just want people to see these bears as the stewards of the land and how they are the king of their ecosystems. And when these ecosystems fall, so will these species. So I'm just using charismatic megafauna. And this book came about because NRDC is deeply involved in this, but the Gateway Pipeline being pushed across Canada from the tar sands to the west coast of British Columbia is going to affect the spirit bear. So I'm using the spirit bear to get people to understand the severity of this issue of putting major oil tankers 10 times the size of the Exxon Valdez through the narrow passageways of British Columbia's waters.
On the cover of this book, Polar Obsession, you have two bears, one upside down.
Right.
This is underwater?
This is underwater, and it's one bear, and it's diving under a piece of ice, and its body is reflecting against the underside of the glassy surface of the water.
A startling photograph.
Thank you very much.
So you've seen some amazing things, I'd imagine, just diving under the Arctic ice, taking pictures.
It's definitely not where most people go, and it's where it's where I go and can make my art and see beautiful things for sure.
Paul Nicklin's photographs have been published in magazines around the world, including in 10 Stories for National Geographic magazine. He will be given the NRDC BioGems Visionary Award. This is the first time you're giving this award?
Absolutely, first time. Paul's the first recipient. We're very proud of that.
And I thank you both so much for being with us. Francis Beinecke, the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, Paul Nicklin, the photographer receiving the award and responsible, at least for the moment, his most recent book from National Geographic Focal Point called Polar Obsession, a gorgeous, very large book. I guess if they publish it any smaller, the impact of these photographs would be lost to some degree.
Well, that's why I want people to lose themselves in the images and in the book for sure. So bigger is better for sure.
Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you
very much.
Us.